Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 13th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everybody. We're almost there. It is 69 degrees and partly cloudy here in upstate New York. And I didn't get to see any of those meteors last night. I went out and tried a couple different times, a little bit earlier and a little bit later. And it was clear sky, but I don't know, 10 minutes standing out there and I didn't see much of anything. So hopefully somebody got to see it because it is quite a sight to see. I've seen them before. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Gates, meaning Billy, good old Billy Gates, RNA vaccine, CRISPR gene drives, Google and chip implants. If you remember, we took a look at some of Bill Gates's most recent investments. He is investing in a vaccine company called CureVax. Of course, we know how much Bill Gates loves vaccines. He's also investing $2 billion of his personal money into clean energy. And I hadn't found that as interesting as I did after I found a document that had talked about, and I think we read this 2 days ago, about how the Department of Energy has been involved in synthetic biology for quite a number of years. That was definitely a surprise to me. And then the third big investment was Bill Gates and 13 other investors pouring $120 million into a gene editing startup. And we had then kind of spun that off into looking at Oxitec, which also was involved with Bill Gates, with the GM mosquitoes and the GM moths, and using their CRISPR technology to edit genes in order to edit in suicide genes, and how absolutely amazingly dangerous that is because it can spread throughout a population and completely wipe it out. There was one final story that we'd read, and we did a lot of stuff yesterday, that looked at the gene editing technology as being the next wave of a weapon of mass destruction beyond, though, any type of damage the nuclear weapon could do, because this literally could wipe out all life as we know it if it got out into the wild reproducing. So, you know, most people, they look at technology and they feel happy because of the convenience. You know, if we get back to like that dopamine carrot that we talked about many, many, many times, one of the things that caused dopamine infusion that made us feel good was an addiction to convenience. And yes, blame Edward Bernays, because Edward Bernays was the one that convinced us that having the convenience of, oh, I don't know, anything, a car, a blender, you know, he was the one responsible for making us this consumeristic society. And here we go again, warm and fuzzy robots. We have Jibo working his way out into the market third quarter of 2015, which is right about now, coming very soon. But I see also iRobot that made the Roomba, the robotic vacuum cleaner, which, by the way, we used to do business with iRobot in the place I used to work, and they are a military contractor. So don't let the warm and fuzzy vacuum cleaner that vacuums without you having to be involved in getting sweaty make you think that it is a happy little toy, because it's not. Well, iRobot has now come out with the robotic lawnmower, and they just gave it regulatory approval. This is a story that came out yesterday in Machines Like Us. Hold on 1 second. iRobot's robotic lawnmower gets U.S. regulatory approval. The future of freewheeling automated yard work took a step closer to American consumers on Wednesday, after U.S. regulators gave robot maker iRobot Corp. technical clearance to make and sell the robotic lawnmower. Now, what's very interesting about that sentence, moving closer to the American consumer, I remember the day I remember the season, actually, that it happens, where technology, networking, computers, it used to just be in the realm of hobbyists and people who had some technical ability to figure out how to make these newfangled things work. But computing back in the early to mid-90s was not a consumer toy. Computing was considered high technology. They paid techs a lot of money to sit on the phone and answer questions from dumb end users. And here's one thing I specifically remember is sale papers, especially at Christmas time. You'd go to an electronics reseller, sale paper, let's say, out of the newspaper. And you would always find consumer products such as video games in one section. And then you would find computer products in another section that was more the high-tech stuff. And I remember the Christmas season that the computing products actually moved into the consumer realm for the dumb-end user-friendly. And that was when Windows 95 came out. Do you guys remember that? We went from Windows 3.1 or 3.1.1 for workgroups where you still had to know DOS and, you know, archaic strings to make things work, to where you had a nice graphical user interface and everything became what they called plug and play, which really didn't work too well. But that was the year that technology slipped from the realms of universities and high business. Typically, we sold back in the early 90s, we were selling to just corporations, and you had an IT guy and specialized educated people to take care of these things. And that Christmas was when computers moved into the realm of the home user. They dropped them to sub $1,000 because that's another big selling point. And computing went apeshit from 95 to 99. There was money falling from the sky. Well, I see that same thing happening right now with robotics and artificial intelligence. The exact same situation. They are trying to slip the willy in to the consumer public that doesn't know any better because it's all for convenience. So we have Jibo. Jibo's coming out. Jibo will be released here Q3. I just said before, it's going to be, I believe, a sub $500 artificially intelligent home helper, right? We should probably play the Jibo video. I hate that thing. I want to start cleaning toilets with its head. But Jibo's going to come out and read your baby stories and face track you, zoop, 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 and be able to take pictures from every angle when you're not looking without your intervention. Jibo is going to be the first step of helpful robotics with a happy, smiley voice into your house. Now, iRobot, the time is ripe. iRobot is coming out with their self-propelled, self-mowing lawnmower that is going to be, again, a convenience for you. But remember, like I said, iRobot is a military contractor. So don't believe anything they tell you. It says the Bedford, Massachusetts-based company, known for its robot vacuum cleaner Roomba, has designed a robot lawnmower that would wirelessly connect with stakes in the ground, operating as signal beacons, rising above the ground by as much as 24 inches. You know, hopefully you don't have any baby bunnies running around in your yard. My God. Automated grass mowers have spread across Europe in recent years. And in the United States, iRobot told the FCC its competitors only offer hands-free mowers that require underground fences or elaborate setups. iRobot's stake design, however, required a waiver from the Federal Communications Commission to make sure that transmissions between the machine and the antennas would not interfere with other devices using the same frequencies. The FCC usually prohibits the operation of, quote, fixed outdoor infrastructure, unquote, transmitting low-power radio signals without a license, and iRobot's lawnmower beacons fell into that category. The National Radio Astronomy Observatory had fought iRobot's waiver request, saying the lawnmowers would interfere with its telescopes. But the regulators waived the rules for iRobot. Yeah, surprise. saying its beacon's design should be safe with the promised limitations on height, signal strength, and use in residential areas. The FCC's assessment agrees with our analysis that the technology will not have a negative impact on radio astronomy, says iRobot spokesman in a statement welcoming the FCC move. Yes, the FCC is taking over the internet, and they're allowing robotic lawnmowers with spinning sharp blades to take over America. This FCC decision will allow iRobot to continue exploring the viability of wideband alongside other technologies as part of a long-term product exploration effort in the lawn mowing category. I didn't know that lawn mowing was a category, but look out, Jibo and lawnmower robots. And if it doesn't get any worse, check this one out. It's a story that came out of fizz.org yesterday. On the origin of, and then in parentheses, it says robot species. If you remember, that was the name of Darwin's book, Origin of the Species, in regards to evolution. Well, this is the origin of the robot species. This is pretty frightening. Researchers have observed the process of evolution by natural selection at work in robots by constructing a quote-unquote mother robot that can design, build, and test its own quote-unquote children, and then use the results to improve the performance of the next generation without relying on computer simulation or human intervention. Now, this is some of the stuff that Kurzweil had talked about, our exponential progress. Once the technology is built and it is robust enough to be able to then use that technology to build the next generation, and they continue to then build the generations beyond that, we're in trouble, people. So now they discover that, yes, there is natural selection at work in robots that don't need to depend upon human intervention to improve themselves over next generations. Research led by the University of Cambridge built a mother robot that can independently build its own children and test which one does best, and then use the results to inform the design of the next generation so that preferential traits are passed down from one generation to the next. Now, if you remember some of the stuff we were talking about yesterday with the DARPA lady, and actually this was yesterday and the day before, with them engineering Mars with GMO organisms. And that DARPA woman had talked about being able to use a database of all of the genetic data of up to 30 billion, I believe she said, 30 billion organisms on Earth, and be able to pick and choose genetic traits from any organism on demand and build a new life form that's better than the ones we have now. Well, how frightening is that, that we also now have robots that apparently are able to do the same thing? Look out, people. Our robot overlords don't look like they're too far away. Without any human intervention or computer simulation beyond the initial command to build a robot capable of movement, the mother robot created children constructed of between 1 and 5 plastic cubes with a small motor inside. And in each of the 5 separate experiments, the mother designed, built, and tested generations of up to 10 children using the information gathered from one generation to inform the design of the next. The results reported in the open access journal PLOS-1 found that preferential traits were passed down through generations so that the quote-unquote fittest individuals in the latest generation performed a set task twice as quickly as the fittest individuals of the first generation. Quote, natural selection is basically reproduction, assessment, reproduction, assessment, and so on, said lead researcher Dr. Fumie Idat, however you say that, Fumie Lida of Cambridge Department of Engineering, who worked in collaboration with researchers at the ETH Zurich. That's essentially what this robot is doing. We can actually watch the improvement and diversification of the species. Are they talking about robot species? They're calling it a species. For each robot child, there is a unique quote-unquote genome, ding, 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 made up of a combination of between 1 and 5 different genes, which contains all of the information about the child's shape, construction, and motor commands. As in nature, evolution in robots takes place through mutation, where components of one gene are modified or single genes are added or deleted, CRISPR-9, and crossover, where a new genome is formed by merging genes from 2 individuals. In order for the mother to determine which children were the fittest, each child was tested how far it traveled from its starting position in a given amount of time, so the speed. The most successful individuals in each generation remained unchanged in the next generation in order to preserve their abilities, while mutation and crossover were introduced into the less successful children. Yes, when they determine which of us are defective, once they get us all into the genomics database, they've been drawing samples and running their algorithms, we will be the ones chosen to be improved in the future as part of their mad science gone mad experiment. Don't think, though, we're going to be allowed to reproduce, because we won't. It'll just see, like, who grows arms out of their forehead. The researchers found that the design variations emerged and performance improved over time. The fastest individuals in the last generation moved at an average speed that was more than twice the average speed of the fastest individuals in the first generation. And this increase in performance was not only due to the fine-tuning of design parameters, but also because the mother robot was able to invent new shapes and gait patterns for the children over time, including some designs that a human designer would not have been able to build. This is just beyond insane. One of the biggest questions in biology is how intelligence came about, and we are using robotics to explore this mystery, says Lita. We think of robots as performing repetitive tasks, and they're typically designed for mass production instead of mass customization. But we wanted to see robots that are capable of innovation and creativity. Yes. In nature, organisms are able to adapt their physical characteristics to their new environment over time, and these adaptations allow biological organisms to survive in a wide variety of different environments, allowing animals to make the move from living in water to living on land, for instance. But machines are not adaptable in the same way. They are essentially stuck in one shape for their entire lives, and it is uncertain whether changing their shape would make them more adaptable to changing environments. Evolutionary robotics is a growing field. Yes, evolutionary robotics. Can you say skin jobs from Battlestar Galactica? This is just beyond frightening. Kill the robots is what I say. Why are we even allowing this to continue? The writing is on the wall, people. And we're going to get back to that Wired magazine article from 2000 about why the future doesn't need us. I cruised along to page 3 and 4, and I mean, it is just beyond insane. While evolutionary robotics is a growing field which allows the creation of autonomous robots without human intervention, and most work in this field is done using computer simulation. And although computer simulations allow researchers to test thousands or even millions of possible solutions, this often results in a reality gap, a mismatch between simulated and real-world behavior. While using a computer simulation to study artificial evolution generates thousands or even millions of possibilities in a very short time, the researchers found that having the robot generate its own possibilities without any computer simulation resulted in more successful children. The disadvantage is that it takes time. Each child took the robot about 10 minutes to design, build, and test. Yes, only 10 minutes. And according to Lita, in the future, they might use a computer simulation to pre-select the most promising candidates and use real-world models for actual testing. Lita's research looks at how robotics can be improved by taking inspirations from nature. And yes, we've talked about that before, that Weiss Institute at Harvard. That is exactly what they are doing. They are utilizing the millions of years of evolution and perfection that Mother Nature has created, and they are bastardizing it by stealing her ideas and turning it into some sort of mutant human machine, human biology 2.0, disgusting end of the world as we know it. Science can be improved by taking inspiration from nature, whether that's learning about intelligence, finding ways to improve robotic locomotion, or any of other related evolutionary traits. And a robot requires between 10 and 100 times more energy than an animal can do the same thing. But Lita's lab is filled with a wide variety of hopping robots, which may take their inspiration from grasshoppers, humans, or even dinosaurs. And one of his group's developments, the chairless chair, is a wearable device that allows users to lock their knee joints and sit anywhere without the need for a chair. It's still a long way to go before we have robots that look, act, and think like us, says Lita. But what we do have are a lot of enabling technologies, yes, or end of the world as we know it technologies, that will help us import some aspect of biology to the engineering world. And, you know, as we're watching this brain project and how they're trying to mimic the human brain as they're charting it all and then creating artificial neurons, this is just so wrong. It's wrong, people. This is not going to give us immortality. That's the dangling carrot that they're promising. We're not going to have disease. We're not going to have death. We're going to have just unbridled creativity to sit around and have scantily clad, perfect body robots feed us grapes while we think about things. It's not going to be that way. All right. Another story yesterday that came out of Machines Like Us. Mass extinctions may accelerate evolution. Well, who would have thunk it? Especially looking at some of the stuff we looked at yesterday and good old Billy Gates involved in all these new technologies that have, you know, if they go awry, every single one of them has mass extinction written all over it. A computer science team at the University of Texas at Austin, and by the way, that university is involved in a lot of military research, a lot of nanotechnology research, DARPA vaccine research. There's a lot of stuff going on there. The University of Texas at Austin has found that robots evolve much more quickly and efficiently after. So again, more robotic evolution. They evolve much more quickly and efficiently after a virtual mass extinction modeled after real-life disasters such as one that killed off the dinosaurs. Well, aren't you glad that they are simulating species mass extinction and seeing how much better the leftover survivors can become once all the losers are wiped out of the loop? Now, wouldn't every eugenics billionaire think that that was a wonderful thing? We're overpopulated. We don't have enough food or water to go around, whether or not it's real or engineered. You can't deny that there's definitely something going on. Scientists have come out and said we are right at the brink right now of the sixth great extinction. Well, hey, simulations have just shown with robots that once they wipe them all out, the last few remaining survivors actually evolve into something way better than they were before. It says, beyond its implications for artificial intelligence, this research supports the idea that mass extinctions actually speed up evolution by unleashing what? New creativity and adaptations. Computer scientist Rizzo, I don't even know if I could try this name, Mikulanian and Joel Lehman co-authored the study published today in the Journal of PLOS-1, which describes how simulations of mass extinctions promote novel features and abilities in the surviving lineages. Focused destruction can lead to surprising outcomes, says Mikulanian, a professor of computer science at the University of Texas at Austin. Sometimes you have to develop something that seems objectively worse in order to develop the tools you need to get better. Well, aren't things starting to make a lot of sense now? Yes, we are moving into the sixth great extinction because why? Crazy people like Kurzweil think that we need to merge with the machine and evolve to become human 2.0. In biology, mass extinctions are known for being highly destructive, erasing a lot of genetic material from the tree of life. But some evolutionary biologists hypothesize that extinction events actually accelerate evolution by promoting those lineages that are most evolvable, meaning ones that can quickly create useful new features and abilities. Yes, like, I don't know, superpowers or something. Mikulanian, however you say his name, and Lehman found that at least with robots, this is the case. For years, computer scientists. So what is this saying too? Like, once we're taken over by robots, even if we kill them all, if there's a few left, they're going to evolve and be stronger than the ones that lived before? Well, it seems so. The team found that at least with robots, this is the case. For years, computer scientists have used what? Computer algorithms, ding, ding, inspired by evolution to train simulated robot brains called neural networks, that's the book I have from DARPA. It's The Beginnings of Neural Networks, and we'll have to read that one of these days, at least do some of it on air, to improve at a task from one generation to the next. But the UT Austin team's innovation in the latest research was in examining how mass destruction could actually aid in computational evolution. In computer simulations, they connected neural networks to simulated robotic legs with the goal of evolving a robot that could walk smoothly and stably. And as with real evolution, random mutations were introduced throughout the computational evolutionary process. The scientists created many different niches so that a wide range of novel features and abilities would come out. And after hundreds of generations, a wide range of robotic behaviors have evolved to fill these niches, many of which were not directly useful for walking. But then the researchers randomly killed off the robots in 90% of the niches, mimicking a mass extinction. I'm just so fucking glad that they are doing research in what happens after you wipe out an entire population, and oh, how much better we come out on the other side. This is just unreal. After several such cycles of evolution and extinction, they discovered that the lineages that survived were the most evolvable and therefore had the greatest potential to produce new behaviors. Not only that, but overall, better solutions to the task of walking were involved in simulations with mass extinctions compared to simulations without them. Practical applications of research could include the development of robots that can better overcome obstacles, such as robots searching for survivors. Yes, it's always to keep you safe. Or robots exploring Mars or navigating a minefield. And human-like game agents. This is a good example of how evolution produces great things in indirect meandering ways, explains Lehman, a former postdoctoral researcher in Mikkelukian's lab, now at the IT University of Copenhagen. He and a former student of Mikkelukian at UT Austin, Kenneth Stanley, recently published a popular science book about evolutionary meandering called The Myth of the Objective, Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned. Even destruction can be leveraged for evolutionary creativity. How great is that? So, in doing a little bit of research, we looked at some of the DARPA stuff and we looked at some of the names that were connected with the DARPA programs that were mentioned in the genetically engineering Mars environment for terraforming. And one of the things that I came across was something called the Biodesign Project. And I was having a lot of trouble finding any information about the Biodesign Project, but I did find something called the Biodesign Institute in Arizona. And they have a promo video, and I just would like to play this promo video to kind of emphasize like how far down the line we are for our own destruction. We are training kids on how to slice and dice biology right now, and we have been for quite a while. So here, listen to this.
At the Biodesign Institute, when we look at the future, what do we see? Is the convenience of our lifestyle contaminating our water? That's what Rolf Halden and his team are investigating.
We are studying the movement and fate of chemicals in the environment and how they get into people and what the effects are. A lot of us buy antimicrobial products. Why? Because that's the first stuff we grab when we reach into the shelves of supermarkets. You can detect triclosan in 99% of breast milk samples from US women. If that message would get out, people wouldn't buy all these products.
What if we could clean wastewater and produce energy at the same time? That's what a startup from ASU called ArgSource discovered.
We'll be adding so much value to the way that water is managed, in the way that waste is converted from what is right now just a costly liability into a valuable resource. The best part about having the Biodesign Institute as a strategic partner is that they bring world-class expertise to our scaling efforts.
Could we harness the Salmonella bacterium, grow it in space, and use it to fight disease? Cheryl Nickerson's work focuses on this intriguing possibility.
What we do with bacteria in space is try to use the microgravity environment of spaceflight to unveil novel clues. Our experiment flew with the Salmonella, so genes were being turned on and off differently than when we grow that bacteria on the ground, because the force of gravity can actually mask certain key cellular responses. Coming here to the Biodesign Institute has been a wonderful opportunity to work with the leading researchers in the field in a very multidisciplinary approach.
See, I'm almost certain that this has to be the institute that's tied in with DARPA, because they literally sent bacteria up into space on the International Space Station to do experiments. I mean, just some university isn't going to be able to do that. I'm pretty certain. And she actually had a picture of like the space shuttle or something behind her. So I am thinking that they're probably involved.
Can we detect disease by looking at our body's natural responses? Stephen Johnston harnesses this technique, known as immunosignaturing, for his work.
It's a way that healthy people can simply monitor their health on a regular basis. The B cells in your body that make the antibodies are just like little sensor bots. And as soon as they see something aberrant, they react to it. So that's why we can see very early disease indications. The immunosignaturing technology is very broad technology. It can be applied to essentially any aspect of health. And we think that that will fundamentally turn around diagnostics.
Hao Yan enjoys doing origami with strands of DNA, finding entirely new applications both for biomedicine and nanotechnology.
We like to extract the design rules from nature The DNA origami is a way to fold DNA molecules into designed molecular architectures at nanometer scale. What we can learn from nature is to create molecular assembly that can mimic nature's complexity, and also to develop programmed drug delivery that can be used to kill cancer in the future.
And of course, I mean, listening to all this, this is just like a complete regurgitation of all of these DARPA technologies that they've been working on. I think that they have infiltrated this university. And I mean, we've talked about this before. They're using this dangling carrot with our children in colleges and getting our children to do all of this research that eventually is going to be human 1.0's demise.
What if we could sequence the entire genome of a single individual for less than $1,000? Stuart Lindsay utilizes nanotechnology to achieve this revolutionary aim.
The nanopore is a tiny hole, little wider than the size across a DNA molecule. So DNA is forced to feed through it like a snake, where some technology can be used to read it. In some senses, like the famous Star Trek tricorder, scan it in front of a person and back comes a full report. And so
the tricorder, that was another DARPA project.
This is going to be a sort of super tricorder, able to extract molecular information unique to every individual.
Yeah, and the way they showed it is that it literally would take your DNA strand and it would run it through this tiny little hole, and every single protein that's going through, it's going to scan it and make a map of you.
What do we see when we look into the future? We see sustainability, energy, vaccines, health, nanotechnology, and treatment. The Biodesign Institute, improving health, protecting lives, and sustaining the planet, celebrating 10 years of discovery.
Yes, it's all about sustainability and saving the planet. That's how they're selling it. All right, there is one other thing I wanted to look at here, and this is kind of long, so we're not going to be able to hear the whole thing, but talking about like transforming nature, there was an interview here, a live talk with good old Eric Drexler, the father of nanotechnology, that I wanted to catch just a couple minutes, and then I'm going to hit that Wired article and read the page 3 to 5 that I wanted to get out.
To make macroscopic products, as it turns out, at low cost and very high performance. And some physics promises us quite remarkable results from that level of technology, what I'm describing in the book as atomically precise manufacturing, or sometimes as high throughput atomically precise manufacturing.
So is that why you have focused on the term APM, atomically precise manufacturing, because nanotechnology, you feel, has really become meaningless?
Yeah, the term... Well, let's see, what happened in outline was people became very excited about, quote-unquote, nanotechnology, meaning something to do with small machines and making things, and popular culture picked up the idea and ran with it off in this direction, and the scientific community included many researchers who were working with nanoscale structures, and it was technology, and they found that when they described what they were doing already as nanotechnology, people became very excited.
Because they're afraid.
Transformative future technology, and they got the impression that scientists were doing it right now. And so the result was that the work went off into a direction largely material science was what was happening in science, while popular culture was going into increasingly fantasy, and that led to a major conceptual and political tangle.
Not to mention that there was about $1 billion in funding probably on the line, and once there's a lot of money on the line, anybody wants to claim it, right?
Yes, so there were billions of dollars of research money were forthcoming, and that put a certain edge to the process.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars of research money into nanotech.
It becomes real all of a sudden when there's money on the line.
Yes.
So, but looking to the future, and with APM and what you used to call nanotech, you, in your new book, you talk about radical abundance. And so what is it about nanotech is, and I will call it that because I like it still, but yes. So what is it about nanotech that would lead to radical abundance?
One has to look at what the technology turns out to be. Physics tells us that that excellent materials, and from that excellent components and excellent products, can be made from predominantly inexpensive materials. the strongest materials, the best electrical conductors, as it turns out, are common materials, carbon, aluminum oxide, and other materials that are abundant in the Earth's crust and the atmosphere. So materials costs are low. The process of bringing molecules together and rearranging structures requires a chemical level of energy, which is nothing extraordinary. The mechanisms that can do that are themselves potential products of that kind of process, and the process itself is very high productivity in the sense of a large amount of product, a large mass of product per unit mass of equipment per unit time. And that comes from a very simple fact, which is that small devices work at higher frequency. A motion crosses a smaller distance, it takes less time, more cycles per second. Shrink machines by a factor of similar machines in their motion and action by a factor of a million, and the operating frequencies increase by a factor of a million. The throughput per unit mass per unit time increases by a factor of a million. And that combination of scaling laws leading to high productivity and atomic precision leading to remarkable products, and this self-applicability that lowers the cost of the machinery itself drives the cost of products down toward the cost of the raw materials and energy. And the raw materials, as I was saying, are inexpensive materials. And
so really what you're saying is manufacturing costs will almost go to zero. And that sounds very reminiscent of what's happening in the digital revolution and the replication of things online.
We're going to stop here for a second because the question comes up, well, how does nanotech have to do with any of this other stuff that we're talking about? But, I mean, they're basically talking about manipulating matter at an atomic level and creating robots at an atomic level that can manipulate matter and build things like the replicator from Star Trek. But they're also utilizing this technology not just to build products, and it's interesting that he's talking about nanofactories building products. They're talking about using these same technologies to manipulate our genes, manipulate nature. The DARPA lady was talking about being able to set this stuff loose in the environment where we've had some sort of natural disaster, and that Biodesign Institute said the same thing, to be able to fix the damage that we've done and make everything better than it was before. I mean, whose vision is going to decide what's better than it was before? I mean, this is just so insane. And I mean, I know you guys have listened to me for the last couple years ranting about this stuff. And when you try to tell other people about it, they don't even believe you. But this isn't fantasy at all.
It was an awfully hard round number.
but close.
Low by present standards. Right. A lot of function for prices that are conservative estimate is around $1 per kilogram. But if you can get a billion processor laptop computers and tablets for $1 per kilogram, that's a large fall in cost.
So the future's going to be free is what he's saying, except it's going to be this complete enslavement society in the name of sustainability.
A little disruption on the horizon.
Prospective economic disruption, yes.
Absolutely. Robots and nanotech take all the manufacturing jobs, all the jobs for everything. I mean, we're not going to have to do anything anymore. So, hey, what good are humans? Well, if you have a great extinction, the next generation will be way better than the one before, apparently.
Supply chains look different, the products look different, and so on.
What do you think that will mean for example, intellectual property? You know, if you could basically, somebody design something, somebody gets a hold of the design, it costs almost nothing to build.
Yeah, you mentioned some parallels to the digital revolution, the information revolution. Those are very strong. The cost structure, including the role of intellectual property, is really quite a good model. Just say a little bit about the parallel with digital systems. On the one hand, you have a nanotechnology, an electronic nanotechnology, which is what digital systems are based on now, that has taken computers and put them onto a chip. Here, we're talking about a mechanical technology, again, based on nanoscale components, but machines rather than mechanical parts, rather than transistors, that can put a factory onto a chip. Again, in both cases, high frequencies. In both cases, working with the finest slices of the domain in question, bits and bytes, atoms and molecules, products on the one side that are patterns of pixels, slices of sound, very general capabilities, and on the other side, again, very general capabilities that come from digital control of small bits of the domain, the domain substance, which in this case is materials. So a radical flexibility, a breadth of productive capacity, which we see in the digital world, has parallels in atomically precise manufacturing, low cost of delivery of products, a high premium on design relative to any other ingredient, all suggest many parallels, including parallels in the role of intellectual property.
All right, I'm going to stop here because this is a 53-minute interview, and I'm sure he goes on and on. I'll find some more good snippets for tomorrow. One of the other things I wanted to touch on quickly before I get back to that Wired article from a couple weeks ago is I dug into the Department of Energy, that thing that we ran across yesterday, the day before, that stated the Department of Energy had been involved in synthetic biology for a long time. And I can't believe what I came across here. It is a PDF out of July 2013 titled U.S. Department of Energy Synthetic Biology Report to Congress. Yes, they've been making reports to Congress about synthetic biology. I can't even get over this, that this is something that has been going on for such a long time in the background, and it's not making any headlines. The executive summary of this report says, in the past decade, synthetic biology has emerged as a distinct discipline positioned at the interface of biological science, engineering, and computational bioinformatics. The recent White House National Bioeconomy Blueprint, which I don't remember that one either, we're going to have to look that one up, provides a definition for synthetic biology. Quote, synthetic biology, the design and wholesale construction of new biological parts and systems and the redesign of existing natural biological systems for tailored purposes, integrates engineering and computer-assisted design approaches with biological research, unquote. Synthetic biology is moving beyond the laboratory and informing the development of new bioengineering approaches in the commercial biotechnology industry. And don't forget, Big Pharma is involved in this as well. Energy production, yes, and here we go. Biomedicine, agriculture, yes, of course, Monsanto, what they're doing to our food, and a variety of other national priority areas stand to benefit from the continued development of synthetic biology research. However, synthetic biology remains in its early phases of development relative to the more mature science disciplines and requires additional basic and applied research and development to realize its full potential. So let's just pull the stopper out and let it go everywhere and see what happens. This report provides a brief overview of the current state of synthetic biology, lists R&D needs in both public and private sector research, and identifies research programs at federal agencies that have current or planned activities relating to synthetic biology. The report also discusses the need for communication and coordination between federal agencies that support basic and applied synthetic biology research to build synergies, considering new R&D needs, and evaluate issues as they emerge. Yeah, like what? The end of life as we know it? Notice nobody's talking about that. In particular, close coordination will be needed to properly consider issues such as development of standards in the field, exchange of information via what databases and other computational resources, and broader ethical, yes, the feds are talking about ethical, legal, social, environmental, and, oh, yeah, here at the end of the sentence, safety concerns. In addition to interagency coordination, opportunities also exist to improve communication between federal research programs, the scientists that they support at academic institutions and government laboratories, and private sector companies that are moving synthetic biology research toward commercial development. Basically, it says they're all in freaking bed together. To realize the potential of synthetic biology as an engineering and scientific discipline and as a new tool set driving innovation in commercial biotechnology, it will be critical to maintain an atmosphere of open information exchange among the relevant agencies and stakeholders in the public and private sector. To me, this is just so unbelievable. So we have had this push at a federal level, working not only with the feds, but the universities and private industry in energy and medicine and agriculture. So basically, you got DARPA, you got biopharma, and you have Monsanto and Syngenta, all working together, vaccines, mad science gunmen, and GMO food. Introduction. In the past, the accelerating pace of discovery and experimental systems biology, high-throughput genome sequencing, and computational bioinformatics have vastly expanded our understanding of the fundamental properties of living organisms and the common principles that govern their functional capabilities. Parallel advances in biotechnology have resulted in more sophisticated metabolic engineering approaches, construction of an increasingly large synthetic DNA fragments, and in some cases, full chromosomes, yes, X and Y, and capabilities for targeted editing of genome sequences in living cells, the gene drive. The synergistic integration of these fields has resulted in the emergence of a new discipline known as synthetic biology. Yes. New and improved human 2.0. The recently released National Bioeconomy Blueprint, and there is a link listed here on the whitehouse.gov site, so I'll drop that in chat after the show because it's a PDF, so it does not look like it's going to let me copy and paste this. I clicked it though. It took me off my story. Don't click. Oh, damn it. Now it moved me to another page. Hold on. And I might have lost my place because it's like a 10,000 page document. Oh, here we go. The recently released National Bioeconomy Blueprint provides a definition for synthetic biology. Quote, synthetic biology, the design and wholesale construction of new biological parts and systems, and the redesigning of existing natural biological systems for tailored purposes, integrates engineering and computer-assisted design approaches with biological research. The field has demonstrated several early advances, developing a variety of tools that now permit the rapid modification of biological systems at a scale of whole genomes, allowing the directed redesign of organisms for specific end uses. Yes. Redesigning biological organisms for specific end uses. Synthetic biology approaches have already been applied to construct new biosynthetic pathways and increase efficiency of biological product synthesis for what? Pharmaceuticals, biofuels, and commodity chemicals. Synthetic biology also provides a powerful set of tools for fundamental research, allowing sophisticated manipulation of organisms to shed light on the principles governing the organization and the evolution of biological systems. You know what that says? That says we are working right now on becoming gods and being able to manipulate nature to do our bidding. That's what that says. Federal investments in synthetic biology research and development have expanded since the initial investment made over a decade ago, with several funding agencies providing support for relevant basic and applied research consistent with their respective mission goals. In order to guide future investments in synthetic biology research and development, its transition into a mature discipline, and its translation to a more robust and competitive industrial biotech base in the U.S., it is prudent to survey current federal synthetic biology activities and to identify how coordinating federal funding efforts can best address the major scientific and technical challenges that the field faces. To address these needs, the White House National Science and Technology Council's Committee on Science, Life Sciences Subcommittee established an interagency synthetic biology working group that represents, with representatives from the following executive branch agencies with current or planned synthetic biology research programs or enabling activities. Now let's hear who we have. We have the Department of Agriculture, the USDA, the Office of Chief Scientists, the OCS, the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, the NIFA, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, the APHIS, APHIS, the Department of Commerce, DOC, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, the Department of Defense, the DOD, DARPA, of course, the Office of Naval Research, the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, the Department of Energy, the Office of Science, the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institute of Health, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, NASA's Ames Research Center, the National Science Foundation, Directorate of Engineering, and the Directorate of Biological Sciences. Guys, put on a seatbelt. We got about 15 seconds left. We're going to have to continue this tomorrow. All right, make sure you stick around because it's Thursday. Mr. Kevin Blanche is up next. And then at 7 p.m. Eastern, we have Ron Stevens with Game On. At 8, Behind the Woodshed with Hal Anthony's new show this week. At 10, Double Crossed with Chuck. And at 11 p.m. Eastern, the Anti-Media Radio with S.M. Gibson. All right, guys, I don't know. There we go. Everybody, have an awesome Thursday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody, take care.